The house itself was built into the peak of the mountain. Like some work of Gothic art carved out of the rock, its adjoining cable car terminal proved the sole link to the outside world. Well, that sounds like that's right out of a movie. How are you, folks? I'm Keith Tolley, your volunteer broadcaster. You have found the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Alfred Hitchcock's wonderful mystery magazine and Tom Mead brings us our first story. It's called Incident at Widow's Perch. Quote, "The plain rule is to do nothing in the dark, to be a party to nothing underhanded or mysterious, and never to put his foot where he cannot see the ground." End quote. Charles Dickens, Bleak House. The letter arrived on cheap paper, almost thin enough to see through. It was a plea from Silas Critchlow, our sesquicentenarian family solicitor. He wanted me to go out to Widow's Perch. Something about the whole thing troubled me. Silas was always such a calming influence, and yet here was a letter that crackled with urgency. It was unnerving. Even the handwriting seemed cramped and knotted like a noose. I can picture Silas now, his creased and kindly face, his voice rippling like mountain water, his fingers gently folded across a fulsome belly. This letter was not the Silas I knew. The problem was Margot, of course. The problem was always Margot. The summer of 1924 was a period of blazing heat in the English countryside, and I drove my little Austin like a demon, the windows open and the soft, sunny air gusting around my ears. The house at Widow's Perch nestled atop an especially precarious crag of granite in the Lake District. The road tapered away to nothing, so the summit was accessible only by cable car. The house itself was built into the peak of the mountain, like some work of Gothic art carved out of the rock. Its adjoining cable car terminal proved the sole link to the outside world. This terminal was little more than a wooden shed housing a panel of electronic dials to control the cable car. You could summon it to the peak and send it down again with a flick of a switch. When I arrived at the foot of the mountain, it was gliding eerily down to greet me. The cable car itself was an Art Deco construction, a steel framework paneled all around with glass to double thickness. The whir of its cables echoed across the valley. The house was built in the 18th century and has been in the Latimer family almost that long. Its isolation is startling, though when you are up there and find yourself surrounded at all sides by vast expanses of purest, greenest England, you begin to see the appeal. Until recently, it had been occupied by my first cousin, Giles Latimer. Giles was a gentleman in the classic English tradition. To meet him was to be ineffably charmed by him. He was older than me by a good 15 years. My last visit to Widow's Perch was for his 47th birthday celebration, an all-night gala affair in December of 1923. My memories of that night at the top of Widow's Perch are mainly a champagne-addled blur, but I know Giles was on top form. He was dressed immaculately in white tie, beaming, and swilling alcohol like some creature out of a Fitzgerald novel. His wife, Margot, was showing off, of course, leading me by the elbow around her menagerie of colorful acquaintances. "Oh, Lady Marshmont loves it out here at Widow's Perch," she said, presenting a sour-faced dowager strung with pearls. "I do," said the dowager. "And this gentleman," Margot went on, presenting some squat naval type, "served with Giles in the war."
"Pleasure,"
said the naval type gruffly, straightening his tie with nicotine-stained fingers.
"Oh, and you must meet Edgar, who's something very big in the art world, Dada and so forth."
"Dada is as Dada does,"
said the voice of a gleefully effeminate young man with wild Byronic looks and a frilled shirt. His comment was met with bemused titters from the assembled company. It was a strange night. It echoes now in my memory like the strains of the jazz band up on that lonely mountain. Less than 3 months later, Giles was dead. Margot, she was the one who found him, you know. She returned from a trip to London and glimpsed through the glass floor of the cable car his broken body sprawled on the rocks at the foot of the cliff. Oh, poor dead Giles wore his smoking jacket and a look on his face as stark and blank as the stones on which he lay. For a short while, questions were bandied about in the community, but as is so often the case, interest in the death lasted about as long as the tabloids could generate a whiff of scandal. This was not long. 3 months later, Giles lay beneath his marbled headstone, dead and quite forgotten, as if he had been gone 100 years. I stood at the foot of the mountain, gazing up at the immensity of rock. The cable car whirred its way slowly toward me, and I referred once again to Silas's letter. Framed in the late afternoon sunlight, there was no question that disquiet loomed over the house on Widow's Perch. Abandoning my own vehicle by a lay-by beside the lane, I stepped aboard the cable car. No sooner was I seated than it jerked away from the ground. The view was dizzying and a little queasy-making. As the cable car drew nearer to the summit of Widow's Perch, I got the feeling that I was being carried towards an uncertain destiny. A young woman waited for me in the terminal. "Gerald, I thought it was you," she said cheerily, as she was a sprightly creature swathed in a silk sundress. "Am I to assume," she went on, "that Silas has been writing to you, too?" Stevie Sparling was Margot's sister. Half-sister? The distinction was never made clear. She was a Knightsbridge bon vivant, part of a youthful tribe of wastrel artists and musicians who drank their way through short and yet pleasurable lives. As we walked up to the house, she explained to me that Margot was about to emigrate. The Latimer family heirlooms currently languished in wooden packing crates. Soon, they would be shipped to some continental villa, never to be seen again, and Widow's Perch would lie empty once again. Stevie was still telling me this when we got to the main hall. There, Silas stood waiting for us amid a ghostly assemblage of towering wooden packing crates. He came over to greet us, his amiable face creased with worry. "Gerald, you're here at last. I see you're catching up with Miss Stevie. How wonderful." "Where is Margot?" I demanded. "Well, she's upstairs. I'm sorry to say she is making a very dreadful mistake. If you will let me clarify why I summoned you both here..." But I did not stop to listen. I thundered up to the first floor, where I found the door to her boudoir open. The lady herself sat at the dressing table, applying perfume and admiring herself like some preening cat. She did not turn to look at me. "Gerald," she said, "I see the old buzzard has written another one of his letters." "What's the meaning of this, Margot? How dare you empty the house without informing me? These are our family heirlooms, treasures which go back generations." Now she spun round, her eyes sparkling joyously. "Oh, so Silas didn't tell you." "Tell me what?"
"Why, Gerald, I could swear you were angry with me. Tell you, of course, that someone is out to kill me."
We gathered, all four of us, in the drawing room downstairs. With an immense and sublime view of the lakes and distant hills, it was a serene backdrop to an altogether disturbing tale. Margot draped herself over the fainting couch, one of those few artifacts which had not yet been pilfered. She was dressed in a loose, crystal-blue rayon dress. Her half-lidded eyes and long dark hair gave her a languid, sultry appearance. The walls around her were entirely bare, with only the ghostly outline of the frames which had once hung there.
"I don't mind telling you all this," said Margot, "because I'll be out of this godforsaken country before I can say Jack Robinson
The fact is that someone is trying to murder me.
Well, she won't listen to reason, Silas cut in. She won't take the necessary precautions.
What precautions, she countered, would you have me take? The fact is that someone has tried to kill me once, and I know for a fact that it is the same person who killed Giles.
Now, that's a step too far, I said.
Giles died in an accident.
Gerald, said Silas carefully, we cannot know that for sure.
Listen to Silas, Gerald, said Margot. All we know is that my poor husband took a tumble from Widow's Perch. We were told it was an accident. Maybe we even believed it. But you and I both know how careful Giles was. Accidents, especially fatal ones, were not his forte.
I collapsed onto the sofa, defeated. You think someone pushed him?
Margot smiled. Well, as you know, I was in London when darling Giles was killed. But what you may not know, because it is a fact I did not present to the police, is that I can prove Giles was not alone here when he died.
She surveyed the audience with grim satisfaction.
I smoke Xanthia cigarettes, as you know. They have a lovely refined taste which suits my palate. Giles smoked only a pipe, a wretched object that makes the furniture smell. But when I arrived back here, I found the ashtray heaped high with brown cigarette stubs, nasty little Turkish ones, which neither I nor my dear departed husband ever smoked. So you see, I know someone else was here with him when he died. That someone killed him, and now, because I know his secret, he is out to kill me.
Well, that's all very interesting, I said. But I've heard a lot of jabber about a plot to kill you with nothing in the way of evidence. Care to elucidate?
You don't believe me, Gerald? Well, Silas, perhaps you'll tell the story?
I turned to the elderly lawyer, who was now regained in his composure. I'm afraid it's true, he said. An attempt was made on Margot 2 nights ago.
Oh, my darling, yelped Stevie, dashing to her sister's side.
I was not present myself, Silas went on, but I have seen the evidence, and I cannot dispute it.
Evidence?
With a sigh, Silas delved into the pocket of his blazer. He then produced and unfurled his fist. Lying on the flat of his palm was a small copper-colored object I recognized as a spent shell of a .38 caliber bullet.
When did it happen? Said Stevie.
After midnight, Margot explained. I was alone in this room, and you know how I cannot abide an empty house. But as it turns out, I was not alone. I heard footsteps out in the corridor. The next moment I glimpsed a figure in the doorway. The pistol was raised, she demonstrated with her thumb and forefinger.
And bang! Oh, darling, you must have been terrified.
Stevie snaked an arm around her sister, who was relishing every moment in the spotlight.
Bang, I said. What does that mean? Well, he fired, of course.
Fired a single round, which missed you completely, I said, unimpressed. At this, Margot scoffed. She swiftly pulled up the left sleeve of her dress to reveal a tightly knotted bandage around what appeared to be a messy wound, caked with dried blood.
He fired once, but I assure you it was all that was required. I dropped like a stone, and the madman no doubt thought I was dead. So he dashed out. I heard his running footsteps.
But how did he escape?
Finally, Margot faltered. Now that is something I do not know. The cable car had not budged an inch. It was the same when Giles was killed. That's why everyone assumes that he died alone. But now, you see, we know different. The killer thinks I know his identity, but of course he's mistaken. All I know about the man is that he smokes Turkish cigarettes and that he has a penchant for gunplay. That's why I'm getting out of the country before any more trouble comes my way.
Now, when are you leaving? Stevie demanded.
Today.
I think that's why poor old Silas summoned you here, to try and talk me out of it.
But why me? I wanted to know. Why did you want me here, Silas?
Because you, of all people, Mr. Latimer, might be in a position to identify the killer of Giles Latimer.
I poured myself a scotch from the decanter on the sideboard. It tasted like acid slithering down my gullet. Now let's all just take a moment to consider what you're proposing. Margot was in London. Somebody, we do not yet know who, visited Widow's Perch. He smoked several Turkish cigarettes. Did he do this with or without his host's knowledge? Before hurtling poor Giles from a summit down a sheer cliff face to his death. He then vanished. Subsequently, several weeks later, perceiving that Margot here had determined his true identity, he returned with a revolver, fired a single shot into his victim, and retreated once more. Is that the proposal you are assuming?
Silence.
Well, if he escaped without anybody seeing him, said Stevie, why did he leave the cigarette butts behind? They were the only evidence that anyone else had ever been here.
Yet another unanswered question, said Margot, springing to her feet. Oh, don't look at me like that, Gerald. I knew you wouldn't believe a word of it. That's why I forbade Silas from contacting you. And yet, mysteriously, he did so all the same. Well, I don't need your help, and I don't want it. I'm leaving this house and never coming back.
But Margot, Stevie spluttered forlornly, what about your luggage, all your little trinkets?
They will be collected by an emissary on my behalf. I, for one, cannot bear another moment of this wretched mountain.
With that, she was gone, out into the corridor, her heels clicking spectrally on the stone.
Well, stop her, please, Silas demanded.
I ran out and along the hallway. Margot had already flung open the front door and headed toward the cable car terminus. Before I realized it, Stevie was at my side. Silas puffed along behind.
We have to stop her, he wheezed. She shouldn't be leaving here alone.
Margot paused before stepping onto the cable car. She turned and bellowed back at us.
Don't try to stop me. When I make a decision, I stick to it.
With that, she flicked a switch on the control panel beside the car. Then she stepped inside and pulled shut the glass door. I made a run after her, but felt Stevie's small warm hand on my elbow.
Let her go, Gerald. She's a willful little thing, always has been.
With a sudden throbbing electrical drone, the cable car jerked away from the terminus and began its descent. I watched the outline of Margot framed in the glass window. Her back was to us, but she did not move.
She's alone, Miss Sparling. That's what concerns me, said Silas. If only she had let one of us accompany her.
That's just her way, said Stevie.
We three stood in the terminal, watching the cable car glide downwards from the peak. I squinted as sunlight gleamed on the glass, but I promise you now that the car was never out of my sight, nor were my two companions. Who was the first among us to realize something was wrong? Was it Stevie? After all, she was the one who ran and turned off the cable car mid-descent. It could have been me, I suppose. I recall yelling something, but can no longer remember what it was. Or perhaps it was Silas, like a Cassandra tortured by his foreknowledge, who, through the whole sorry sequence, never uttered a word. The cable car, now dangling limply midway between solid ground and the peak of Widow's Perch, was suddenly swallowed by a ball of orange flame. I remember Stevie screaming. I remember Silas, the old family friend, silent at my side. But most of all, I remember the sight of that burning cable car and the flood of terrible emotions I experienced in the aftermath of the inexplicable death of Margot Latimer. The interior of the car itself was scorched entirely black. Margot's remains, such as they were, sprawled face down. The hideous truth was that she was no longer recognizable as a human, let alone as the glamorous and victorious woman who had departed less than a minute ago. She was just a heap of charred flesh, from which plumes of smoke curled upward in the soft summer air. A week later, when I was presenting the startling facts of the case to my acquaintance, Joseph Spector, I paused at this point to allow him to digest the details of that most barbaric of crimes. In a piquant example of nominative determinism, Joseph Spector was by trade a spiritualist medium. By vocation, however, he was a criminologist. Spector had an uncanny knack for peeling away the layers of a mystery. I often marveled at the dazzling capabilities he displayed when dealing with murder, in a purely amateur capacity, of course. We were seated in a snug, low-slung alcove of the Black Pig in Putney. As an alehouse, it was one of the Spector's favorite haunts, not for the drink, but for the privacy. He sipped a mysterious green concoction from a sherry glass and then turned his soft, watery blue eyes to me. "Spontaneous human combustion," he said, relishing each word. "Quite a thing, that." "But there's no other explanation," I heard myself say. "Police found no flammable substance on the inside of the cable car. Nothing that could have caused a spark." We had been talking since lunchtime, and it was now close to 4 o'clock, and our discussion showed no sign of abating. The staff at the Black Pig were used to Spector's consultations and knew to leave him well enough alone whilst he cogitated on crime. "Nothing," he repeated, gazing through me. "I must congratulate you on your storytelling capabilities, Gerald. You certainly know how to spin a tale." "It's all true, Spector, every word. But I must take issue with your characterization. From your description, Silas is a jovial and jocular family retainer. But when we encounter him in the story, he's a rather tedious and sepulchral fusspot." "People are not types, Spector. They can't all perform exactly as we expect them to, and I must say that tensions on Widow's Perch were running somewhat high. And yet there is one person in this story who behaved exactly as anticipated. Someone who lived up to type, in spite of what you say. Mrs. Margot Latimer. I pictured her as a flighty, carefree soul, unafraid to drop everything at a moment's whim. She did not disappoint me. Who else would have left Widow's Perch without taking so much as a handbag?" I leaned back in my seat. The aged wood creaked under my weight. I hadn't considered that. "Did you consider, perhaps, that she may have been fleeing what she perceived as a very imminent danger?" I did not reply. I was staring into my own beer glass, picturing Margot as she stepped onto the cable car. "Do not try and follow me," she had said. "I don't suppose," Spector said idly, "either Miss Sparkling or Mr. Critchlow smoke Turkish cigarettes?" I shook my head. "Silas smokes a pipe, like Giles, and Stevie smokes whatever she can get her hands on." "And you yourself?" "No, I don't smoke. I suffered a lung disorder as a child, and I am prone to infection." Spector digested this. "I see. Gerald, you will think me at worst a lunatic and at best highly unorthodox in my reasoning, but I think I can identify the person who visited Giles on the night of his death." He fell silent. I watched him waiting for more. "Well? You've heard of Wilbur Hemsby?" I had. The name was vaguely familiar. "Hemsby?" Spector, sensing my confusion and delighting in it, charged back. "How would you describe your cousin Giles? A careful man, I think you said?" "That's how Margot described him. The truth is that he was something of a fuddy-duddy, handsome and clever and all the rest of it, but rather set in his ways." "What was his profession?" "Well, for some years he worked as a financier in the city, but then he came into his inheritance and he had no further need to work." "But he retained a keen eye for business?" I shrugged. "I can't really say, Spector. We were not close." "Very well, I shan't beat about the bush. Gerald, it was Wilbur Hemsby who visited Giles at Widow's Perch. the very night he died.
How can you know that for sure?
Well, it's fair to assume that Giles was expecting a visitor that night, and that it was someone he did not wish his wife to know about. Whether or not he expected this person to murder him is another matter altogether. Nevertheless, it explains why Giles waited until the one day his wife was in London before agreeing to host this person at his home.
Spectre had finished his drink. I quickly summoned the barmaid and ordered another.
I always tended to think that a businessman is born rather than made. I believe Giles Latimer continued to pursue certain business interests long after his apparent retirement.
Why not? After all, he needed something to keep his mind active up on that isolated peak.
I would also suggest that these business interests were something he worked hard to keep secret from his wife.
I think I see where this is heading. You're trying to say that Giles was involved in something illegal.
Well, perhaps not to begin with. Perhaps he initially only looked on it as a harmless hobby. But I think he soon saw the possibilities, the vast quantities of money to be made.
Now what are you talking about?
Smuggling.
I looked at the curious old man sitting across the table from me. He was utterly serious.
He continued, I put it to you now that Giles Latimer had got himself involved in the illegal smuggling of heroin into the country, with Wilbur Hemsby as his accomplice. That when Hemsby visited him that fateful night on Widow's Perch, it was not to murder him, but to warn him.
But who is Wilbur Hemsby? You still haven't explained where you got his name from.
Spectre chuckled.
Forgive me. I have a habit of letting my ideas run away from me. The morning of June 6th, the morning, I think, that Giles' body was discovered at the foot of the cliff, the body of Wilbur Hemsby was also found in the offices of the Red Star Shipping Company in Canary Wharf. The cause of poor Wilbur's death was a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the temple. Perhaps you came across the story in the papers?
His operation had been compromised. A police informant had managed to infiltrate the gang. He knew he had little time left, so he decided to take the easy way out.
Ah, I murmured. I'm beginning to see now. Yes, it's quite simple, really, though Hemsby did not mention in his suicide note exactly who his accomplices were. He did discuss certain partners, men of apparent respectability who funded his operation. I think Hemsby went to Widow's Perch to warn Giles that their venture was fatally compromised and that the police would soon come calling. During their conversation, I am in no doubt that he smoked a sequence of increasingly distraught cigarettes. I am also in no doubt that when he departed from Widow's Perch by cable car, your cousin Giles was still very much alive.
The fresh round of drinks arrived, but I was listening too intently to Spectre's tale to notice the brimming beer glass at my elbow.
Giles summoned the cable car back to Widow's Perch once Hemsby was gone. Then, his mind racing with the new and terrible information he had just received, he wandered the halls in anguish. Finally, seeing no conceivable way out of this mess, he stepped up to the precipice and leapt over the edge.
Well, now this is all conjecture, of course, I said. I mean, what proof have you got that Giles even ever met this Wilbur Hemsby?
Oh, none whatsoever. In fact, it is equally likely that the two men had never met in their lives. Wilbur Hemsby was a ship captain, while Giles Latimer was a wealthy financier. What reason could the two men have to meet? In fact, I believe that once Hemsby's vessel, the Merrimus, is scuttled, there will be little enough evidence that the poor man ever existed.
The Merrimus? What language is that, Greek?
Spectre gave a barely perceptible little smile.
Turkish.
I sat up, my elbow jolting the beer glass and spraying froth across the table.
All right, let's suppose what you say is true. Giles was a suicide. You've solved the mystery except, of course, for the little matter of Margot's death.
One thing at a time, dear boy. Let us take to begin with the peculiar assassination attempt which she described to you that day. The mysterious figure who appeared in the doorway of the drawing room and fired a single gunshot which grazed her left arm. At this point, we must pause to ask a salient question about Margot Latimer. She told you that she categorically did not know who had murdered her husband. Since we are now operating under the postulation that her husband was not murdered at all, but whose death was the result of suicide, we need to ask ourselves exactly what Margot did know. Did she know, for instance, that her husband had in place a vastly generous life insurance policy, a policy which would pay out in the event of murder but not in the event of suicide? Perhaps this goes some distance towards explaining her conduct. My mouth dry, I took a hefty glug of beer. So she faked the murder attempt to make it look as though someone had killed Giles when the truth is no one did? Spectre sipped the curious green concoction. You realize, Gerald, I have no means of proving any of this. You present me with a problem and I provide a solution. Whether that solution is accurate is a matter for your own conscience. All I can say is that it would be a comparatively simple affair for Margot to inflict that wound upon herself, then concoct an appearance by a phantom gunman, to disguise a suicide as murder in order to ensure she obtained what she perceived as her marital dues. I finished my beer in a few frantic swallows, slamming the glass down on the table in triumph. But this is where your theory falls down. Somebody did kill Margot. Spectre downed the remainder of his cocktail, emanating a satisfied sigh. You're correct, Gerald. This is where my theory falls down. But the smile did not leave his face. I could not take it a moment longer. Well, there must be more to it than that. Perhaps you're right, Spectre conceded. Ask yourself this. What is the one customary feature of suicide? Present in a vast cross-section of cases, but apparently absent in this case. A suicide note, I responded instantly. Just so. If Margot found the suicide note, she would have almost certainly destroyed it. But now we must speculate as to exactly what the note contained, not just a confession, but an incrimination. He was watching me closely, trying to gauge my reaction and the almost clockwork ticking of my brain. Let's get back to the heart of the matter. Margot Latimer stepped onto a cable car, which began its descent within a matter of seconds. She was alone, as far as we know. She carried nothing flammable about her person. Now we know that there had been no genuine murder attempt. There was no conceivable reason for her to fear for her own life. So she must have had another reason to leave Widow's Perch in such a hurry. I wonder what it may have been. This is no time to play the coquette, Spectre. Before I purchase a sixth round of drinks, I want to know precisely what you are driving at. Oh, and you shall. But first of all, he smacked his lips, I must confess to a perishing thirst. When the fresh drinks arrived, he continued, it is essential to question positively everything. We know, or think we know, what you saw that day. Speak up if I am incorrect, but I believe you saw a woman unadorned by trinkets stepped into a death box of steel and glass. Suspended in midair by wires, she burst into flame. There was no visible spark, nor any inflammable substance present in the car, correct? I nodded. Incorrect. I happen to believe that there was both a spark and an inflammable substance. We know that Margot was a smoker. But there was no evidence of any cigarette packet or lighter about her person when she died. So we must think harder. How would you describe the weather that day? Summery. The sun was high and hot. It reflected on the glass as the cable car moved.
Spectre leapt on this. "Is that right?" he demanded.
"Well, yes."
"Why?" Spectre rubbed his chin.
"Could be significant. Let's take another step backward. Margot's sister, Stevie, I believe she may have said something important."
"All I remember about Stevie that day is her telling me Margot's plan to strip Widow's Perch and relocate to the continent."
"When Margot announced her intentions to leave that very day, what was Stevie's immediate response?"
"She said, 'What about your luggage and your trinkets, correct? Or was that a misquote?"
"No, that's what she said."
"And just what trinkets was she referring to?"
"Jewelry, I suppose. Margot did have a fondness for shiny knickknacks and baubles, watches, necklaces, and the like."
"What, you think it was one of these trinkets that killed her?
Like a cigarette lighter or something rigged with an explosive?"
"Oh, no, no, nothing so elaborate. If I'm correct, this was a trinket which performed the very function for which it was crafted. It took a few seconds, but that was enough to kill Margot Latimer."
"Let me get this straight. Someone laid a trap for her?"
"A death trap, yes. It relied upon a single unfailing personality trait of hers, greed. She could not wait to leave Widow's Perch, could she? And at a time you naturally thought this was because she feared for her life, but now we know you were mistaken. So what prompted her sudden departure? The promise of a hefty cash payout waiting for her at the bottom of the mountain. Let's say that Giles left behind him a suicide note, which Margot discovered and later destroyed, and that in that note Giles named a silent partner, someone who had taken part in this illicit dealing. Someone you had previously thought above reproach? Someone like, for instance, Silas Critchlow?"
Spectre waited for my response, but I had none to give. He persisted.
"This knowledge gave Margot the upper hand over poor old Silas, and that was a position he could not permit. It was within her interest to perpetuate the idea that Giles had been murdered. But she also knew that this revelation about the trusted family solicitor afforded her an uncommon opportunity for blackmail." Following a wrangle with Silas, the two reached an uneasy accord. They agreed to persist with the idea that an unknown quantity had killed Giles and that this same person was now out to kill Margot. This would permit Margot to claim her insurance policy, thus buying Silas a little breathing space. You say it was Silas who summoned you and Stevie to Widow's Perch?
The first glance, this seems an unusual move. But when we consider it carefully, we see a classic example of reverse psychology at work. Silas invited you to the house at Widow's Perch in order to distance himself from the crime he was about to commit. He worked things out with Margot very carefully, provided her with written instructions and strict orders not to open them until she was on the cable car. Perhaps, he told her, the instructions would lead her toward claiming the money with which he would pay her off. Perhaps she expected a bank account number. This explains Margot's restlessness and itch to depart as soon as possible. But, and this is the important part, he made two things very clear to her. First of all, that she must board the cable car alone. Second of all, that she must open the letter once she was safely moving back downhill. To her credit, she followed these instructions to the letter. This is where the trinket of hers comes to play. We have tiptoed around it with talk of lighters and cigarette cases, but does it seem beyond the realm of possibility that Margot may have carried on her person a magnifying glass? A stylish, ornately crafted reading lens was a more than acceptable and fashionable substitute for a pair of eye spectacles. Silas was well aware of this, as I suspect was Stevie, though she may have claimed to have forgotten it. You tell me that no inflammable substance was traced within the cable car. Not to dispute your word, but I believe this to be inaccurate. What if I were to tell you that Margot doused herself in the substance which ignited with a single spark?
But how? I stammered.
When you first saw Margot, what was she doing?
She was in the bedroom.
Doing what?
Spraying herself with perfume.
Spectre grinned. I think you are beginning to understand. Silas doctored the perfume bottle with a substance, something easily obtainable like white spirit. When Margot applied it liberally to her wrists and to her throat, she sealed her fate. The dress she wore was made of rayon, which itself is very quick to burn in the right conditions. When she boarded the cable car, I believe she quickly and eagerly produced the envelope containing her instructions, as well as the magnifying glass. The typical behavior on such a sunny day, and with a document printed in what you have described as Silas's cramped, knotted handwriting, and on such cheap paper, would be to angle the document toward the sunlight to make it easier to read. We may now put two and two together. The sunlight, magnified through the glass lens, may cause paper to burn. If the paper, too, is coated with a flammable substance, a sudden spark is assured. The fluid on Margot's wrists and throat, as well as the flimsy rayon, caused her to burn like a firebomb. Of course, the fire incinerated any trace of the document Silas was preparing for her. It is easy to imagine Margot in her death throes, flinging the magnifying glass through the shattered window of the cable car, never to be retrieved. He folded his arms in satisfaction. "And there you have it," he said. "Spontaneous combustion explained."
It's fantastic.
Well, of course, I didn't say it was true. I merely presented you with one possible explanation. If you have another, I'm happy to hear it.
I just can't believe that of old Silas.
Didn't you tell me that people were not types, that it's pure folly to try and see into the dark heart of a man? Well, now, I must confess, Gerald, that I am feeling a sudden thirst. We parted after a final round of drinks. I was a little unsteady on my feet as I clambered into the back of a cab, but Spectre seemed none the worse as he waved me off from the curb, leaning against his silver-tipped cane. My head was swimming, not just with the series of ales I had quaffed, but with the blur of ideas Spectre presented that afternoon. As we headed toward the beaming lights of the West End, I tried to picture amiable old Silas as a heroin smuggler and a devilish murderer. I could not do it. Spectre was inordinately clever, though, no question about that. Perhaps too clever. We all know that a little imagination can be a dangerous thing. The revelation a few days later that the elderly solicitor Silas Critchlow had been arrested at the Bermondese home on undisclosed charges gave me a similar jolt. The newspaper print was small, and I found myself angling the paper toward the window. I read the story over breakfast, barely comprehending its intricacies, the letters blurring together in the glow of the morning sun. It's now the turn of the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, a story by Josh Pachter, and it's called The Adventure of the Red Circles.
Two chemists walk into a bar, said Anatoly Arkavian, his thick Russian accent, waving an unlit cigar to emphasize his words. And the bartender says, "Greetings, gents, what can I do you for?" The first chemist ponders a moment and says, "I believe I'll have a glass of H2O. "Coming right up," says the bartender, and he serves the man some water. The second chemist says, "I suppose I'll have a glass of H2O, too." The bartender looks a bit skeptical, but he fills the order, and the second chemist dies.
Only Ellery Queen laughed. The four other people in the room, Sires, the multimillionaire, Vreeland, the psychiatrist, Darnell, the attorney, Emmy Wandemir, the poet, simply stared at the bearded, bald biochemist in mystified silence. The second chemist asked for H2O2, Ellery explained. That's hydrogen peroxide. It's a strong oxidizing agent used to treat infections when applied topically, but a deadly poison when ingested. So, you're suggesting the bartender was also a chemist? Asked Darnell. Then why did he serve the poor man a drink he knew would kill him? Did he know the second chemist from somewhere? Vreeland said. Did he have a motive for the murder?
Shall probably, Arkavi sighed. What's wrong with you people? This isn't tonight's puzzle, it's a joke.
Ah, said Emily Wandemir, soberly. A joke. Ha-ha, then. Sires, their host, rapped his empty glass sharply on the arm of his wheelchair. He was the founder of the Puzzle Club, and at 90, the oldest member of the group by 15 years.
Well, now, speaking of tonight's puzzles, he wheezed, I have, as you know, managed to coax Charlotte out of retirement to prepare another of his sumptuous meals for us, and we wouldn't want to spoil, so perhaps we best go down to cases. Elle, you're in the hot seat this evening, and I believe you'll find the conundrum we've cooked up for you particularly tasty.
Ellery took his seat in the overstuffed Chesterfield, the members of the Puzzle Club affectionately referred to as the problem chair, and swallowed the last of his scotch and soda. And Charles the butler appeared at his side and presented him with a new one on a silver tray. Dr. Vreeland, clearing his throat and beginning the evening's story.
Well, Jeremiah Red Edwards is the owner of 24 Big Red Inns, a very successful chain of Long Island grocery stores, he said. Once upon a time, his hair color gave rise to his nickname, but now in his late 50s, he has, alas, gone completely bald. Rather like our good friend Professor Arkavi. Unlike the professor, however, he has also gone completely dead, apparently a suicide, with a single gunshot wound in his chest and a small-caliber revolver still clutched in his right hand.
And before you rabbit off on a wild goose chase, my dear boy, put in Miss Wandemir, the strength of her mixed drinks perhaps accounting for the weakness of her mixed metaphor, let me assure you that Dead Red was, in fact, right-handed and not a southpaw.
Thank you, Emmy, Vreeland nodded. I should have said so myself. To continue, Red's body is found slumped over his desk in the library of his sprawling estate in the appropriately named incorporated village of Muttontown by his manservant, Jeeves, said Ellery tentatively.
The psychiatrist frowned.
I was going to say, Juan, but you're in your honor, Queen. But why not? Jeeves it is.
He sipped his martini and resumed his recitation.
Now, as I say, he is found in his library by his manservant, Jeeves, surrounded by his extensive collection of rare first editions of Golden Age detective novels. The library's bookshelves are filled with the works of John Dickinson Carr, Agatha Christie, G.K. Chesterton, S.S. Van Dyne, and, oh, yes, a certain Ellery Queen.
Now, when the medical examiner has completed his in situ examination of the body and the corpus has been carted off to the morgue, Darnell took over. The investigating homicide detectives find a red grease pencil and the proofs for next week's Big Red's advertising circular lying on his desk, where the dead man's body had previously hidden them from view. Red's weekly habit, Jeeves informs them, is to mark up the proofs with the grease pencil, and he has in fact done so with the first page of his layout. But the document is folded open to the page featuring specials from the cheese department, and on this particular page, instead of his usual additions and deletions and corrections, Red has circled the photographs of four
of the items on offer and numbered them 1 to 4 in the following order. A 16-ounce jar of grated Romano marked down from $12.99 to $10.49. An 8-ounce Brie round for $6.49. A 5-ounce wedge of smoked Gouda for $7.95. And a 4-ounce tub of feta crumbles at $2 for $7.39. At the bottom of the page, in the otherwise blank margin, the dead man has drawn a 5th red circle, inside which he has scrawled the numeral 5. "Our first question, of course," said Sires, "is was he, in fact, a suicide, or was he murdered?"
"I'll give you a hint," said the poetess. "He was murdered."
"But in true dying message story fashion," the multimillionaire continued, "he survived long enough after being shot to circle and number the 4 cheeses on the proof sheet and add an additional 5th circle and number as a cryptic means of identifying his killer. And, don't be shocked now, there are 3 suspects. First,
ladies first,"
Miss Wandermeer cut in.
"After all, cherchez la femme and all that. The most obvious suspect is Red's wife, Emily. She's been carrying on with the gardener, an immigrant from Cairo, and wants a divorce so she can marry him. Sadly, Emily hasn't got a dime of her own money, and Ahmed is not merely dimeless, but penniless. Red, of course, wouldn't divorce, so the best way to the man's money is to murder her honey."
"This is what got you a Pulitzer?" murmured Ellery.
"Suspect number 2, said Anatole Arkavi, "is Red and Emily's son Edward. His name was Red's idea, and being stuck with the name Edward Edwards might perhaps have been motive enough for him to shoot his father all by himself. But there's more. Young Edward is, you see, an inveterate gambler, and more to the point, an inveterate loser. He is deeply in debt to his bookie, who is threatening to break one or more of his most important appendages if his account isn't satisfactorily settled. Edward begging his father to bail him out of his awful situation, but Red flat out refused. And Edward, like Emily, inherits in the event of Red's demise. Equally 50-50. And we're talking about millions here, Mr. Queen. There's apparently quite a bit of cabbage in the grocery business."
"Third and finally," said Darnell, "we have Albertson Kroger, the owner of a competing chain of stores. He's been losing market share to Big Red's in recent months, and he would be thrilled to see his main competitor's empire thrown out into the sort of a turmoil that would inevitably result from the death of its owner."
"The police have checked to see if each of them has an alibi?" asked Ellery.
"Indeed they have, and Inspector Veeley, Inspector Thomas Veeley, by an odd coincidence, his father used to work for your father in the olden days. He has assigned his best detectives to the alibis of the 3 suspects, and each of them seems to have an ironclad one."
"Yeah, there you have it, L," said Sires. "You're entitled to the usual 1 hour to ask questions. Would you like to begin with the details of the 3 alibis?"
"No," said Ellery. "I don't need to ask any questions, and I couldn't care less about the alibis. I was just being polite when I mentioned them. In fact, I've known who killed Red Edwards ever since you told me about the contents of his library and those 5 red circles. Frankly, I expected the 5 of you to come up with something more challenging."
Challenge to the listener. Who did kill Red Edwards, and how did Ellery know?
The solution.
"All right, Mr. Smarty Pants," said little Emily Wandermeer. "Which of the 3 suspects killed Big Red?"
"None of them," Ellery smiled.
"You made a point of telling me that the dead man was a fan of Golden Age crime fiction. He circled 4 cheeses on his advertising flyer and numbered them 1 to 4. Romano, Brie, Gouda, and Feta, in that order. In other words, first a Roman cheese, second a French cheese, third a Dutch cheese, and fourth a Greek cheese."
"Damn and blast," said Dr. Vreeland. "He's done it again."
It was obvious to me, of all people, Ellery went on, that the four circled cheeses were references to my first four novels in order of publication. The Roman hat mystery, the French powder mystery, the Dutch shoe mystery, and the Greek coffin mystery. The fifth circle was drawn around an area of white space, apparently because there was no Romani in the inns. But this is what got you an Edgar? Murmured Mrs. Wandermere. But it was quite plainly meant to point to the title of my fifth book, The Egyptian Cross Mystery. I suggest the police check into the alibi of Mrs. Edwards' lover, Ahmed, the gardener from Cairo.
Speaking of cheese, Sires said as the door to the dining room swung open and Charles announced that dinner was served.
I believe Charlotte is starting us off with a delectable Welsh rarebit.
Allow me, said Ellery, taking Emmy Wandermere's arm. If we hurry, we'll just be in time for the first course. Well, my friends, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of all ages, thank you so much for joining me. I'm Keith Tyler on the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. You can listen to this and most other Sun Sounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Go to sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Join me again next time, will you please? Thanks. Make sure your I love yous are in order. So long.